Shalom Aleichem, everyone. It's Binyamin Hammer at the National Council of Young Israel. We're thankful to have Rebbe with us for our conference call number 36. Thank you, Rebbe.
You're very welcome. Question number one. If someone has reassignment surgery, does their halachic status change? For example, someone was born with male genitalia, and after the surgery has female features. Can he still be counted for a minyan? Are there any changes regarding Hilchos Yichud? Additionally, when this person passes away, should the Tara be done by men or women? Unfortunately, this is a reality which we have to face in this country, something which we never heard of before. There's a whole sefer called Dor Tapuchos. Dor Tapuchos Hema, a pasuk in Sefer Devarim, about people who somehow want to, as you put it, reassign themselves from in this case, from male to female. The reverse also exists. What is the halacha? The answer is you cannot reassign yourself. If you're born a boy, a male, you're a male. You're born a male, you are a male, you will be a male, you'll die a male. You're a male. You cannot change your gender. Impossible. And therefore, technically speaking, you count for a minyan. There are technical problems which we spoke about in the previous conference call. For example, where the person's going to sit. This person wants to sit sometimes in a ladies section. And ladies may not want that. The men may not want to sit with someone who presents like a female with female features. It's a serious problem, and they're difficult situations that Rabbanim have to face sometimes. But in any event, to answer the first question, in principle, he can count for a minyan. He's still a man. As far as the Isur Yichud, we have to first understand, what does the word features mean? He said he had male genitalia, and now he has female features. They're very careful to question it with his words. So if you look on Wikipedia, they explain this reassignment, that it starts with hormones, and some, after the hormones, make the person look a bit more like a woman than a man, they'll perhaps stop growing a beard, things of this nature. They may do surgery to change the face. There's what they call breast augmentation. And then there's a catch-all phrase, and they change the genitalia as much as they can, whatever's possible. It's not clear what it means. What do the words mean? It's not clear what the words mean. It seems to me that when you talk about the Easter of Yichud, it all depends on the realities. Easter Yichud with whom? So if this individual who was born male and now considers himself female is involved sexually with men, it seems to me that there would be an Isur Yichud with a man who engages in these kinds of practices. Presumably the same would apply to two gay men who are active for the same reason. Whether this individual has had a radical surgery which tries to simulate female genitalia, and that's what this individual is doing with other men, or whether it's what we call shaloka darka, in either event, two individuals who engage in illicit practices. So the same way as the practice itself is illicit, presumably there's an Isur of Yichud. However, I do not believe there would be an Isur Yichud of this person with a man who will call straight, not with a homosexual individual, nor with this transgender individual. I do believe, however, that the Isur of Yichud with women continues to exist. if the genitalia are somewhat intact and he's capable of normal relations, it certainly applies. Even if not, if you look at Ultra Poskim and Simon Chav Beis Oz Beis, there's a discussion of an individual, a male, who's unable to have bia. And even there, according to most Poskim, there's an Isra of Yichud, some disagree. That will depend upon that dispute. As far as the sad question of Atara, Yoredeya Simon Shin Nun Beis Siv Gimel tells us, based on the Tosefta, this Mesekos Machos, that a woman is able to take care of a man, Tara, etc., but a man may not take care of a woman, and the reason is presumably because of Hirurim. A man that's taking care of a woman's body can accommodate Hirurim, which can lead to Zera Levatola, etc., whereas a woman does not have that anatomical feature, and therefore, whenever there's a doubt, if someone's female or male, when in doubt, you'd give it to the ladies, Chevra Kadisha. However, if his body looks like that of a man, presumably it's better for the Chevra of the men to do it. They shouldn't tell the Chevra that the person became transgender, and they may not notice it completely. This is after consultation with Rabbi Zon Shalita, the head of the Chevra Kadisha of the Vat of Queens. Question two. There are shuls that have flat-screen TVs in their lobbies that display Zmanim announcements and pictures of recent shul events. Is there a problem with having these TVs running on Shabbos and Yom Tov? Does it make a difference if the TV is built into or physically attached to the wall versus sitting on a TV stand like a regular TV? It seems to me it would be a serious Easter of Zilzul Shabbos to have a television running in the lobby of a shul. If it's showing pictures and things of this nature of shul events in terms of, you know, sometimes they have videos, things of this nature. It doesn't belong in a shul lobby. Ideally, it should be disconnected in people's homes. In many homes, people have a computer, and the normal feature is that the pictures keep coming one after the other. Certainly prefer to turn the console off before Shabbos. Again, video would be worse than stills. But in any event, it should be turned off. However, when it comes to Zmanim, just the time when you're daven Shachas Mincha Marv, that I believe is permissible, just like a regular bulletin board, but it should be built in or attached to the wall to give a bulletin board type of effect instead of having it separately on a stand, which looks like a TV. Question three. What is the earliest time on Kadavim Marav Motzi Shabbos? Is it allowed to daven Marav before Shabbos ends? Do you say Atachon Antonu? Shas Atcha Godol, one can daven Marav on Motzi Shabbos as early as Plaga Mincha, without the Chon Antonu, as it's quoted in the Gemara in Masechta Brachos in the fourth parak, found in the Shulchan Aruch, Orach Chaim Siman Reish Tzadi Gimel, Siv Gimel. If you're an Anus, you have no alternative. What's an example? You can't daven later for whatever reason. Let's say you want to make Avdalah. You can even make Avdalah before Shabbos ends, of course, only with the wine and nothing else. If you can't make Avdalah afterwards, you'll be somewhere else. There would be no wine available. So there are very rare cases of Onus or Shatat HaGadol when it is permissible to daven Marav before Shabbos ends, to say, in a normal situation, the earliest time to daven Marav is ideally Tesa Kochavim. And the Mishnah Brura, in that same Siman, Siman Reish Tzadi Gimel, tells us that one of the reasons not to daven Marav before Shabbat is over. It's for fear that people will hear, Baruch Hu, it's already time to do Malach, which is, of course, a mistake. That reason, of course, applies whenever you daven Marv, even if it's what we call Ben HaShemashas, people will think, oh, you're davening Marv, so Shabbat is over. So therefore, according to that Mishnah Berurah, and common sense, it's better to not daven Marv until Shabbat is already over. When Shabbat is over, it's, of course, a matter of dispute in and of itself. So ideally, you shouldn't daven Marv until an hour after Lich Benchen or 42 minutes after the Shkia, which is, in this country, considered to be the earliest time for Shabbos being over. If that's totally impossible, they should daven a little bit earlier, but time it that the Havdalah, that they make a shul, should be after that time. At least 42 minutes. For Moshe writes, at least 50 minutes for the Havdalah. Every shul is different. The Rav has to know what the Balabatim can handle. We say in the Zemiris, Hama'achrim l'teis min hashabbat. Everybody sings it in Zemiris, so are they willing to conduct themselves the way they express themselves? Generally speaking, we don't understand where's everybody running about the Shabbos. Where are they going? So the proper shul practice is to wait at least 42 minutes to daven Marv and Motzei Shabbos under normal conditions. Question number 4. Is it mutter for babies and infants to play with muktzadik toys on Shabbos that contain batteries where lights and sounds go on by their touch? How about sitting in high chairs or walkers that have these items attached? Is it permissible? Until what age? Shmir Shabbos Kilkosa and Perek Terzayin Ha'ora Yud says, if the item is primarily a toy, not primarily to sing tunes, it's permissible to move it. It's not really mukta. Maybe a klisha malach to liyisr, because it makes noise, but it's mutta l'tzarach gufo. It's mutta for the purpose of using it. And if you look in the same Sefer Shmir Shabbos, Perek Chof, Ora, Chof Ches, based on the Tosfos and Erev and Samach Tes, L'tayel esatinok, something which is needed to walk the little infant to calm him down, is not considered to be in the category of mukta, and it's permissible to give the item to the baby and the infant, because there's no prohibition for the child to make noise. It's not considered from his perspective to be what we call an uvdu d'chol. Until what age? Until the age that the infant needs this toy. As long as he needs this toy, so it's necessary to be lenient for this baby who needs the toy. Obviously, once he no longer needs the toy, so then it's not right that they should be making these noises on Shabbos. But the next question, Shul has a little boy 5 years old with Down syndrome, whose parents bring him on Shabbos morning to our youth groups. The parents schlep along his favorite toy, an electronic dog, whose eyes light up and sounds come out. Obviously, this attracts the other kindergarten-age children who play with the boy and play with the toy. Some parents have shared their concerns with me about their children playing with muktza. What should I do here? Seems to me obvious that the baby who's 5 years old with Down syndrome needs this toy. Other children don't need the toy. So it's possible to explain, even to five-year-olds, that this boy is what they call today special needs. That's the jargon. And we have to be very sensitive to the needs of special needs children. And the Torah itself takes this into account. It's an important lesson for children to understand. And therefore, the other five-year-olds, if they're helping out the special needs child of Down syndrome, and part of the help to help that child is to provide for him this favorite toy, just as the parents are allowed to bring it to shul for him, so too these kids are allowed to give it to him and play with it as it relates to him. However, they should be told at the same time that for those who don't need this toy, and the average five-year-old would not need such a toy, it's inappropriate to use it on Shabbos. I'm hopeful that most five-year-olds will be understanding enough to make this distinction. Six, the community hospital and rehab facility is a good walk from the Orthodox shul to accommodate loved ones who visit on Shabbos and for their patients. They have built a minion room on an upper floor to accommodate them. Balabatim walk on Shabbos to make the minion in lane. The facility does not have a Shabbos elevator. Guests who visit walk up the stairs. What about the rehab patients who are not on this floor and need the elevator? Can they use it to daven with a minion? A. B. Are we allowed to ask the Gentile nurses to bring up the patients in the elevator to be part of the minion? The answer to both questions is the same. The needs of a chole she'ein bo sakana may be achieved by asking a non-Jew, Simon Shin Chav Ches and Aruch Chaim Sif Yuzayin. It's clear to me that those who are in rehab are in this category of Chol Hashem Bo Sakana, so they may be taken by some non-Jew in the elevator to the minion, and you may ask the non-Jew to take them in the elevator to the minion. Question 7. Can packages delivered on Shabbos and left outside the home be brought in by a Jew on Shabbos if there's a concern that the package will A, get ruined by bad weather, B, be stolen? C, not concerned about weather or stolen, but does not want to leave it outside for it disturbs his own Shabbos. Here too, the Shemir Shabbos Kukhasa discusses it. In Perek Laman Aleph Sivchaf Aleph, he said it's okay. He quotes from the Das Torah of the Maharsham. As long as, of course, it's an Eruv, no problem of carrying from outside the door to inside the house. And of course, if it's not muktzah, if it's muktzah, you're afraid it may be muktzah, there's room to be lenient to move it with your foot from outside the door inside the house. Look at Mishnah Berurah, Siman Shin Yud Aleph, Sifkot Lamed, Siman Shin Ches, Sifkot Yud Gimel. This is called Tiltul Begufo, or sometimes called Kalachayad in the abnormal fashion, which the poskim amatir, even the tzorech hamuksa, not just the tzorech gufa mekomo, as we mentioned earlier, even for the purpose of the muksa, so it should not be lost until we paskin halacha lemais. Question 8. What is the halachic value of exercise versus snius? In certain communities, there is a kosher separate gym available, but this is only in certain neighborhoods. In others, one either has the option of exercising on their own, or the gender-mixed group. Not everyone is self-motivated towards exercise, so a group can provide motivation. Another option is personal training. This is much more expensive. If separate classes aren't immediately available, is one required to travel a large distance, such as an hour, to attend such a class, or to pay a premium amount for a personal trainer, rather than join a mixed class? Each case must be decided on its own merits. It depends certainly in part on the need for the exercise. If it's critical, for example, to lose weight, to avoid diabetes or heart conditions, then there's a very clear reason to be lenient to allow this person to exercise properly. As opposed to someone who's exercising for beauty or for strength, it's not so critical. And then we'd have to look at it more strictly. Go down into the details. It depends. If it's a woman who's doing the exercise and she dresses appropriately, so then there's much more room to be lenient. As we mentioned in the very first question, you don't find Issur here with respect to women. And therefore, if she dresses b'tznius, even though the men may not be dressed so much b'tznius, and certainly the women don't matter, so it would be permissible for her to join this gym if there's no alternative. With respect to a man, it depends. It depends, number one, how the women are dressed. It depends, number two, how old the man is, how old the women are. And it depends, number three, if it's possible to find a corner in the gym and face in the direction that it will not be necessary to look at the women were not properly dressed or doing exercises which the man shouldn't be seeing. So every case has to be measured independently. To travel an hour to a gym, I don't think it's going to work. It's just it's going to be bottle. A trainer, of course, is the best if a person can afford it. I take this opportunity to once again be very vocal against any using of a trainer of the opposite gender. Unfortunately, and I say with pain, there have been cases of this type with a male trainer with a woman or vice versa, which have led to the literal violation of Losinov. Very, very sad. To my mind, it's absolutely prohibited. Question number 9. What about the practice of yoga? A member of my shul has been attending classes taught by a frum man to the male-only class. This question was discussed with another Rav, who said it would be permitted as a form of exercise as long as no idolatrous chants accompany it. The class given by a frum young man doesn't involve chants, but includes peaceful Indian music being played during the ending rest period. Some of the yoga poses involve bowing. While the bowing was meant for exercise and the music for relaxation, would there still be a problem since the original sources for these may be idolatrous? If you look on Google, there's a dispute way over in India as to the meaning of the word yoga. Some say it means unity, which presumably means the unity with the Hindu deity, which would be much more severe. But apparently the most authoritative individual says no. It just means focus and peace of mind. Of course, that's required even nowadays, these goals. That being the case, it seems there's room to be lenient, because the peaceful Indian music is simply for the purpose of peace of mind. And since, according to the more authoritative view, as I heard it, it's most the word yoga means focus and peace of mind and not unity, there's more room to be lenient, at least as far as the music is concerned. Obviously, bowing is more problematic. It smacks of Avodah Zarah. It's not so necessary. You need peaceful music to relax. But why must you bow? Get an impression from the question that the frum teacher only included the peaceful Indian music, but not the bowing. Therefore, you get an impression that there are other classes where there are bowing, but not in this class. So, go to the frum class and don't bow. Or if you go to the other class, no alternative, try not to bow. What about the rabbi who said it was okay? He must be 100% convinced that the source is not Avodah Zarah, in which case it would be permissible, as I mentioned earlier. But since I'm not 100% sure, I would say you should avoid the bowing if it's at all possible. Question number 10. I have a congregant that was asked to participate in the wedding of a family member that is being officiated by a conservative rabbi. He was asked to recite one of the Sheva Brachos. One, should he agree to participate? Two, would it make a difference if he was a rabbi that was connected to the family? Not sure if he is the family member or the more likely the conservative rabbi. Three, are there other, quote, kibbudim that would be either more or less objectionable? Well, if the chuba v'kiddushin is kedatzu kedin, then technically speaking, be permissible to recite a bracha, since at the end of the day they're married. Kedatzu kedin, of course, includes two kosher witnesses. If there are two kosher witnesses, even if the rabbi who's conservative would be a non-believer, even if he didn't keep Shabbos, doesn't matter. The couple is still married because he said to her, Harayat, and he gave her a ring in the presence of two kosher witnesses. I must discuss in this context the double ring ceremony, which is very common in conservative circles, and even in some Orthodox ones. It seems that if they know that only the man giving the ring to the wife creates the marriage bond, then they're married. And you can tell the Chasam Kala that. Only his ring creates the marriage. If they think that the exchange of rings creates the marriage, they may not be married. Rav Moshe has a bunch of tshuvos about this. The Eben Ezer, Chelek Gimel, Siman Yud Ches, and Chaf Hei. Seems to have some doubt in the latter case, whether they're married or not. If they think that it's only the exchange of rings, which you know exists in other religions, Eben Ezer Siman, Chelek Dalet Siman, Lamed Beis, Oz Beis, talks about that. That's when it comes to reform, as opposed to Orthodox. That's Rav Moshe's distinction. Reform, they may very well not be married because they think it's the exchange of rings which makes the marriage, and that's not the case. Whereas Orthodox, they presumably understand it's only the husband's ring which creates the Kiddushin, and then the woman says what Rav Moshe calls Hevel. You know, whatever statement she makes, presumably she would say, I need a dodi, v'dodi liya, something along those lines, not a lashon of she's being Mekadoshim, which would be very damaging. And on this topic, there are some who have tried to be mevatel kiddushin, to cancel a marriage by saying, well, it was a double ring ceremony. That's not enough. According to Rav Moshe's simple reading, that's only when it comes to a reform rabbi, not an Orthodox rabbi. He doesn't discuss conservative, which is somewhere in the middle. So it's you have to be careful with that. What were they thinking at the time of the marriage? I do not believe in this case that by accepting a bracha at this wedding, you are giving legitimacy to conservative rabbis. Technically speaking, you don't need any rabbi to get married. He can do it himself, or he can get a Masadic Lushan as a mister. So since the Shas HaTzchak, I wouldn't worry about that quote-unquote recognition. Obviously, it's b'di'evet. If the rabbi is from the family of the Chasam or Kala, it's more lenient because he's doing it as a family member, not as a rabbi of a conservative community. Other kibudim, if there's a ksuba to read, if it's a conservative ksuba, you shouldn't read it, even though reading is, as we know, not a halachically significant activity, but it might be considered some kind of recognition of their text. If it's a standard text, I think you can read the ksuba. Other kibudim, it's hard to discuss. I assume that the person is related, is likely puzzle for all the other kibudim as a karuf. Okay. Question number 11. I recently went to a periodontist for a consult on tooth implants. He explained that my bone has decayed and he will need to build up the bone before he can perform the implant. To build up bone, he grafts bone that he purchases from a bone bank and fuses it to my existing bone. He explained that the bone is real and comes from dead people who donate their bodies to science. Is this mutter? If yes, is it mutter for a Kohen to receive it, and is it mutter for a Kohen periodontist to perform the procedure? If you look in the Yoredeya, Siman Shin Mem Tesif Aleph, you get an impression that everything is usur. It's an Issa Ano from a mace. According to the Mechaber, it seems it applies even to a non-Jew. You look on the side, in the bottom, you look on the Nekudas HaKesef, he seems to be lenient that there's no Isser Hanar from a Nachri, or in Pesachet Shuva Sifkat Nalef, if there is any Isser, by a Nachri it would be the Rabbanan, and permissible for a Chole She'ein Bo Sakana. Presumably if he has, his teeth don't work, it's a Chole She'ein Bo Sakana. So even according to the Pesachet Shuva, certainly according to the Nekudas HaKesef, be permissible on the assumption that the tooth bone or whatever the bone is coming to help in his periodontist tooth implants is coming from a non-Jew. That's the assumption. We're living in a non-Jewish country, and Eretz Yisrael might be different. What about a Kohen? Well, we know that Etzem Kisaora Metamed is a certain minimal sum. The way it works, I believe, it's certainly true, I was told, with respect to the dentists, as far as teeth are concerned, as far as bones are concerned, maybe the same thing, which means the bones are crushed and built up again, it's almost to a flour-like consistency. If that would be the case, it's not metame, and mutter for Kohen to accept it, mutter for Kohen to place it, handle it. If it is an etzem kisaora, the bone is not reduced to small segments, then it's a serious problem. We have to ask and find out what could be done. The Kohen should look elsewhere, both if he's a periodontist or if he's a patient. I believe that there may be alternatives. Question number 12. How can one differentiate between a shela on a chicken due to discoloring or a broken bone and something that happened during packaging? Are there general rules for what is okay, what isn't? Do all questionable chickens need to be brought to an expert posik or the general guidelines? There's one simple general guideline that we rely on the kashrus organizations. You get a chicken these days, it always has a people who are careful, it always has a good kosher symbol. And the assumption is that the people know what they're doing in the slaughterhouses. And therefore, if there's discoloring of broken bones, we have to assume that it took place during the packaging. And therefore, the chicken is 100% kosher. Otherwise, you're hard-pressed these days to find experts in Nichos Treifus, since almost everything is taken care of now in the original slaughterhouse. I believe the answer is to rely upon the kashrus organizations. Question 13. Can a frum doctor during residency or fellowship switch his on-call with a non-frum colleague? Does it make a difference if the non-frum doctor offered because he knows that you don't want to be there on Shabbos? What guidance can be offered to a frum resident / fellow who tries to avoid Shabbos call but is sometimes in the hospital on Shabbos? If he gets out late on Friday, can he take the train home if it means he's arriving after Shabbos started? Well, even the hassle on Shabbos has started. All very good questions. Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa Perek Mem Sif Chav Gimel prohibits switching with a non-from colleague. Refers back to Perek Lamed Beis Hera Kuf Chav Hei, where he says that the non-from physician with whom you switch and who works on Shabbos will be in violation of Chilul Shabbos, even if he's saving lives, because he's doing it just to make money. Mitzvah Tzrichas Kavana. In order to be Zoche Shabbos, you need a mitzvah to save lives. This is a very questionable psak. Others disagree strongly and say, no, the doctor comes to heal. Look, he wants to get paid. But that's true. We all want to get paid for what we do. But his main kavana is to heal. And if he was told that the bill's not going to be paid at the end of the day, presumably, if he's a good doctor, he'd come and heal anyway. And therefore, it seems to me that contra the Shemir Shabbos Kilchasa, every effort should be made to switch with this non-Shomer Shabbos doctor for two reasons. The frum guy can stay home with his family. And the non-frum fellow, you're saving him from a lot of Chilul Shabbos. Because instead of being Mechal Shabbos doing silly things, he's Mechal Shabbos to save lives. And as I said to you before, that it seems he does fulfill the mitzvah, even though he has in mind as well an ulterior motive of making money. It doesn't matter. It's Michal Shabbos of Pikuach Nefesh. And even if he will do things in an inappropriate fashion halachically, the right what shouldn't be written, the what shouldn't be done, not so necessary. Nonetheless, presumably you're reducing the number of Isurim that this fellow is going to commit by being a resident or a fellow in a hospital scene on Shabbos, where so much of what he does is for the pikuach nefesh, as opposed to if he's in the street, in the mall, and then in the ballpark, where he's doing much worse and many more violations. Lif Naiva doesn't exist, he can do it without you. And Misayaya, if you look in your Rabbi Kivega, your Adeya, Simon Kuf Payav Sivav, Misayaya is only a problem if you're making it worse for him. If you're making it better for him, then you're reducing his issue. You're not Misayel over Avera, you're stopping an Avera. The example given over there is someone wants to shave with a razor. If he shaves with a razor, he's in violation of two violations, shaving and being shaved. So someone else should grab the razor out of his hand, and he should shave him. Ah, but the person's in violation of being shaved. Okay, that's only one of two. So too over here, he works in a hospital on Shabbos. The likelihood is he's performing less sinful behaviors of Shechilas Shabbos than he would otherwise. What if a frum doctor is in the hospital on Shabbos? Got to try everything you can to avoid any Issa Daraisa. Whatever has to be written, you try to write before Shabbos. If you're stuck writing on Shabbos, you write whatever you can now on a computer. Nowadays, Obamacare requires to go paperless. And now many forms are just on a computer. Writing on a computer is not so serious. It's not exiva d'oraisa, pepshuto. And therefore, if that's what's going on in the hospital, so write it only, you know, by typing it into the computer. And if it needs to be put on paper right now, let a goy press the button. And if it can wait, so you press the button after Shabbos is over. If it's absolutely impossible, you must write something on from pen and paper. So write with a shinui. Some say you get an invisible pen, which disappears. It's hard to rely upon those. You write left-handed. That would not be considered a ksiva d'oraisa. Now, this is true no matter whom you are treating. Even if you're treating a Jewish patient. If you're treating a non-Jewish patient, here I concede the point to the Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa, that Kavana plays a critical role. Because if you look in Shmir Shabbos, Perek Mem, Ha'ora Mem Aleph, based on the Chasam Sofer and others, the heter for a frum doctor to take care of Enem Yisraelim on Shabbos is not to save the Enem Yisrael directly, which is a serious problem, and certainly Melacha D'oraisa on Shabbos, but rather to save the Yisraelim. Because if the observant doctor is not going to take care of of such a patient, then Chas V'Chalila, the doctor can be in danger, could be even all Jews are in danger. That same footnote, he quotes the Chofetz Chaim, is Machne Yisrael, Perek Lamed Aleph Sif Aleph, that perhaps it's what's called a malacha she'ena tzricha legufa, because you're not directly interested in the refuah itself. You're just trying to stay out of trouble. Perhaps that's a tzricha legufa. He said if you ask for money to be paid, then it's already tzricha legufa. And therefore, it comes out he's not doing it for the refuah proper, but to avoid what we'll call eva. According to the Chofetz Chaim, it's not pikuach nefesh proper, as the Chasam Sofer said, as Rav Moshe said, or Chaim Chelik Dalet Simon Ayin Tes. He can't believe that the Chofetz Chaim didn't realize that if a Jewish doctor won't save a non-Jewish patient, the patient dies, that the doctor and all the Jews are in danger. Soon in the time of the Chofetz Chaim, Rav Moshe writing back in Europe. Fine. If there's no alternative, you have to stay late on Friday. I believe it's permissible to get on the train if it's going to get to your destination on Shabbos. I believe in such a circumstance, the person should go on the train in his scrubs, in his doctor's uniform, whatever he wears in the hospital. So everyone should realize, see a guy with a yarmulke on Shabbos on a train, it's a zilzul on Shabbos. A zilzul on Shabbos in some ways is even worse than a real, real violation. If you look in Simon Tuf Kuf Chof Vov, in Mishtabruo Lamazayin and Sharatian at the end of Oth Nun, you get an impression that riding a horse, or maybe today means riding a car or a train, was considered a very serious violation of Kavod Shabbos, serious zilzul, and therefore should be avoided at all costs. But the doctor was a special case because he's saving lives. I believe he can get on the train before Shabbos. He should get on in his medical uniform. Everyone knows he's a doctor. And that will not lead to much of a zilzul in Kedushas HaShabbos. Even to leave on Shabbos, which is the last part of the question, I believe it's permissible to try to make sure that you get into the train beheter. These days there are MetroCards. Either you have someone walk you from the hospital to the train with a MetroCard, you know, it's just a one-ride MetroCard. You buy them up in advance, and they'll swipe it and put it down the garbage. If they can't, no one can walk you, perhaps you can take the MetroCard and move it in a manner of shinui, put it in your cuff, put it in your shoe, in an abnormal fashion. And if possible, when you get to the station, ask some nice non-Jew to take it from wherever it is and to swipe it for you. Sometimes you can make an arrangement with the person who's sitting there on the behalf of the MTA, the subway authority, and they can do it for you if they'll be nice. Shasat Chagoro, I guess, because it's such a serious issue of taking care of patients, there's absolutely no one else around. Perhaps we can permit that the person swipe the card with a shinui in a backwards manner somehow or other. If there's no subway, we can perhaps even allow to go home by taxi for a similar reason. It's Amir al-Nakhri, and it's to enable a person to take care of patients who need him. Otherwise, if we do not permit him to go back with a non-Jew, my fear is he will make a calculation. I'm not going to miss the whole Shabbos with my family for the next 20 minutes of taking care of this patient. I'm just going to leave early, leave it to the capable assistant. That may be a wrong decision. A wrong decision which could be very hurtful if the patient suffers later as a result. Jew or non-Jew. And therefore, I believe it's necessary to allow the individual to go back with a non-Jew if necessary, so that he should not make the mistake we described earlier. I call it a heter of pikuach nefesh. If you can't go back, you may decide you don't really need me there, when you really do need you. You're, as we read, hashochad yavein epikhim, the shochad of being home with your family is strong enough to cloud your decision, which could lead to a sick person in the hospital becoming endangered. Not what we call hitiru sofa mishum tchilasa, which has various parameters. It's simply a straight question of pikuach nefesh. But to drive yourself is not necessary. You can always get a goy. It may cost you money, so it'll cost you money. Question 14. If a shelf was pulled out of a warmer to get the food that was in the back of the shelf, can the shelf be pushed back in, even though the food that was towards the front of the shelf was out of the warmer? Are there circumstances where food can be put into the warmer on Shabbos? The word warmer is a bit vague. I understand the warmer to be what's commonly known today as a warming drawer, which has become extraordinarily common these days. think most of the boys in my shir have warming drawers in their homes, which is certainly not true a short time ago. So the answer is, it's a very serious problem because it's called hachzara, putting something back into a tanner is much more serious than putting on top of the tanner. And Shulchan Aruch says in Simon Shindun Gimel, Reish Nun Gimel Arachayim Sivbeis, that it's prohibited to be magzil litocha, as opposed to al-gaba. Nonetheless, if you look carefully in the original sources, the so-called Ran, the Masech Shabbos, Mr. Brewer, you get an impression that the reason why we're more strict when it's in the box as opposed to on top of the box is because of nirik and mevashel. It looks more like cooking when it's in rather than when it's on. It seems to me that does not apply to a warming drawer at all. No one cooks in a warming drawer. And therefore, there's no difference whether it's in the box or on the box. Well, we know the rules, the famous rules. If it's on a fire, not in, and you satisfy all the conditions, the fire is covered, and you have in mind to return it, and it's fully cooked, and it's dry, and you hold on to the pot, you may return it onto a covered fire. It's not clear to me whether holding on to the shelf with your hand, as opposed to holding on to the pot with your hand, would satisfy this requirement. It's a good question. I'm not sure the answer. So therefore, because of this lack of clarity, a person should try to arrange his pots, or her pots, that when you take the food out on Shabbos, that the food which is most to the outside should be the food that comes out first. And when you take it out, make sure that the food which is inside remains within the cavity, if you will, of the warming drawer, so it never came out at all. That's what should be done. Now, putting into the warmer on Shabbos from scratch, it's called Hanocha B'Tchila. So, although we had suggested there's no Nirik and Mevashel, no one cooks there, but it's what's called a violation of Shema Yechata B'Gacholim. You may adjust the fire. To my knowledge, every single warming drawer is adjustable. If the dial to adjust it is inside the drawer, which is apparently the more common case nowadays, the possibility of covering the floor of the warming drawer with a large piece of aluminum foil and have the foil slide up in the front near where the dial is. It's one piece which is bent, and it covers the dial. I believe that's a valid hecker. So when the person opens it up on Shabbos, he sees right away that Shabbos is not permitted to adjust the dial, if you cannot do that logistically. Or if the dial is on the outside, which does exist, sometimes it's even on top when the warmer draws from the bottom, then covering, lining the bottom of the warming drawer will not help. It's not a hecker. You don't even see it. The only possible hecker is what we call toch betit, based on the Gemara and Shulchan Aruch, Reish Nundalit, where they would take plaster over the entire area. It's a very significant reminder not to do anything, and that would suffice to eliminate any problem of Shema Yechata B'Gacholim. I believe that you're not going to start plastering today. The equivalent of plastering today is many pieces of strong tape, duct tape, or some equivalent, in a manner in which you couldn't pull it all off in one shot. If it gets complicated, then by the time you would pull it off, you'd remember it's Shabbos, and you will not come to adjust the fire. I saw Aruch HaShabbos, beautiful sefer. It seems to allow even one piece of scotch tape to satisfy the talk with the requirement. I find that leniency to be very questionable. Finally, question 15. The shul has a large contingent of older people from Russian descent that drink vodka and other alcoholic drinks like some would drink seltzer. They even have alcohol by shalda shudas on the table. There's another person in the shul that is an active AA member and feels that by Kiddushim, somebody should be watching over any alcohol to prevent underage drinking and overdrinking. He himself says that he doesn't feel threatened by it as he drinks on a separate table, not near the food. However, he feels that in general, shuls should be taking a more active approach to preventing alcohol problems in the community. What should we do? Absolutely. Absolutely. Every rabbi has a responsibility to see to it that people do not get drunk in his shul. Never. Not Simchas Torah, not Shabbos, not Purim. Getting drunk is very dangerous and totally inappropriate, especially in a shul. And if the balabatim in the shul can't control themselves, he should make his shul either a totally non-alcohol zone and make kiddush and grape juice, or at the very least, allow only wine and prohibit whiskey and beer, which many shuls have done. This is part of the rabbi's responsibility. If the balabatim can control themselves, and there are many who can, he has to warn them not to get drunk and not to give alcohol to someone who's underage. I believe the law was the age of 18. Don't give them to drink. Number one, it's against the law. The shul can get into trouble and the person can get into trouble. And as our rabbis put it, chamira sakanta meisura. The danger is more serious than the prohibition, whether it be a prohibition by secular law or by Jewish law. There was a case in my own shul a number of years ago where there was a bar mitzvah and there was many, many parents sitting around. There was one table in the middle with all the boys around 13 years old. And under the noses of all the adults who were there, they weren't paying such careful attention. These kids were daring each other. One kid drank a tremendous amount of wine. He looked terrible. A tzaddik carried him on his shoulders to the parents who called that tzala. They rushed him to the hospital, had to pump his stomach to save his life. This can happen in any shul. You have to be careful. And it was only wine. Everything has to be done in proper measure. It's up to the discretion of the Rav. But if the Rav insists and he sees that there's overusage of alcohol, he must prohibit it. And if Balabatim tried to go against the Rav, he should take the bottles and break them. You can break them on Shabbos or before Shabbos. That's the end.
Rebbe, thank you very much. We hope we can call on you again in a few weeks. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Kol tov. Bye-bye.
Kol tov. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.